Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. Now, how Facebook tried to manipulate your mood. We'll find out about the recent experiment that our social media overlords conducted to see if certain words they fed us would make us happy or sad. And we'll have a little chat about the ethics of this little game with Adrian LaFrance, who is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Adrian. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And do you say LaFrance like an American, or do you say LaFrance?
I say LaFrance like an American, and French people are disappointed.
So people will, now that France is in the quarters of the World Cup, then, you have a lot more people saying France and waving French
right.
flags and stuff. And, the French quarter of Manhattan, wherever that is. All right. Back in early 2012, Facebook messed around with the news feeds of more than 600,000 users in this kind of mood test. What exactly did they do?
So Facebook was interested in trying to see, tried to study what they call emotional contagion. So the idea was to figure out whether they could lead people to experience the same emotions without their awareness. And so what they did was they altered the what someone might see on his or her news feed, so that main page of Facebook where you see all your friends' status updates, and in some cases made the news feed as a whole more positive or more characterized by friends who posted things using positive words, and in some cases more negative. And then they tried to see whether, in response, the person who saw this more positive or more negative news feed would then themselves post words that were more positive or more negative. And so the conclusion they came to was that, yes, seeing more positive posts makes you post more positive posts yourself, and the same thing on the other side with negativity. So that's sort of the basics.
In other words, it did, right?
Right. And you know, I have to say there, with all of the sort of fury over this, which in many cases is justified, one point that is sometimes lost is the extent to whether this experiment actually worked, you know? So this question of just because people use a positive or negative word, does that truly reflect how they feel? And so I think a lot of psychologists would question just the nature of the experiment itself.
Huh. And does it affect how other people feel? So if we can all hold our outrage for a moment over being manipulated like this, which we'll get to, what was actually learned from this experiment?
Well, I mean, what they say they found is that being exposed to more positive content makes you post more positive content. And the way they would put it is, you know, again, that they could lead people to experience the same emotions without their awareness.
And why would they want to do that?
That's a very good question. The way Facebook puts it is they want to make the service better for you. And so in a public post by one of the study's authors over the weekend, he explained that they had concerns that seeing, various posts might have a negative effect on people. And they wanted to sort of figure out, okay, what can we show people to where they have a better experience on Facebook? The extent to which, I mean, whether that intention makes it okay, like, it is up for debate. But they say they were just trying to make a better Facebook experience for everybody.
So, listeners, what do you think about Facebook manipulating what you see on your news feed to try to see if it would affect your mood? 212-433-WNYC. This just came into public awareness a few days ago, even though it happened in 2012. Is this blowing up your Facebook feed? Are you outraged? Do you care at all? 212-433-WNYC. Do you feel like a guinea pig, or are you resigned to the fact that this kind of thing just happens online all the time? All kinds of commercial interests are giving you all kinds of messages for all kinds of self-interested reasons. And 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Nobody gave consent specifically to be part of this study, but apparently what they did was legal. So can you explain why, Adrian, under what corner of the law?
Well, so, you know, I'm not sure we can say for that it was legal at this point. I think what we know is that Facebook's current terms of service, so that sort of checkbox that you mark that enables you to use the service, does have something now that tells users that by using Facebook, they're agreeing to have their data used for research. There was a Forbes report, though, that came out, I think, last night, that called into question when that aspect of the terms of service was added. So one reporter suggests that it wasn't until months after the experiment was actually conducted that the terms of service updated to include this clause about data being used for research. That I haven't confirmed myself. Facebook is not answering many specific follow-up questions other than putting out comments. And so we'll have to look into that some more. But so I would say the legality is still, to me, uncertain. Yeah. But one of the bigger questions that people have is the ethical one. So this question of, you know, standards for consent. And if humans are being manipulated, experimented on, to what degree are they, you know, told about it ahead of time? And most academics, I think most people would hope that they'd be given a chance to opt in or opt out.
So here's a little ethical context, I think, from college professor Chris in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I work at Pratt Institute. I'm an ecologist, but I usually do I do a lot of educational research.
Uh-huh.
And I'm working on some teaching tools, and I would like to test them on my students. But if I want to do that, I need to go through an institutional review board, an IRB. It just seems to me that this Facebook agreement is not the same as an IRB.
And should be?
Probably should be, yeah, because, I mean, I think that, if you ask anyone in medicine, anyone in any kind of human studies, this is kind of the gold standard for ethics, and it's very specific. I mean, when you tell a participant about what's going to be involved in the study, you have to be extremely specific about what you're going to do. Sometimes you're allowed to be general enough so that you don't give away the study, but certainly you give them some parameters of what's going to go on.
Chris, thank you. Adrian, you know about this, right?
I do. I've learned a lot, actually, in the past couple of days. But, yeah, this question of IRB, the Institutional Research Board, is a really big one, because when the study sort of first blew up in the past couple of days in terms of public awareness, the Princeton psychologist who edited it and accepted it indicated that they had gone through an IRB, an Institutional Review Board, one of these, usually a university board that makes sure that the study and the research practices are sort of up to snuff in terms of ethics for human research. It since has come out that Facebook didn't use an Institutional Review Board. They may have consulted one at Cornell. The timeline isn't clear. And we're told they didn't have to actually go through that process, so they used an internal review board at Facebook. Of course, Facebook has not given us many details about what that process entailed.
Craig in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I was curious about what you feel about the idea of generating revenue, advertising revenue, and how this connects to that, because it seems to me that our behavior most of the time is more directly involved with how much can we click on things, how often can we click on things. So if this manipulation of behavior is directly related to trying to get a higher click rate for advertisers and thus generate higher advertising revenue, in addition to potentially selling that data to other businesses who might be interested in it for reasons other than just advertising revenues.
Craig, thank you. And that's a central question, I think, Adrian. If Facebook was figuring out whether certain words and context for uses of those words would put us in a better mood, was that because Facebook has an inherent interest in putting us in a better mood because it's in their interest to improve the moods of the Facebook users of the world? Or was this a vehicle for advertising?
Right. So I think you raise a couple of really good points. And I think some of why there's so much outrage over this is it comes down to some contextual questions. So a lot of people already understand that Facebook is routinely tweaking what we see in our news feeds because they're trying to figure out how to better serve us advertising. But where this is different is, you know, we weren't aware that they were also tweaking with our news feeds as a way to sort of toy with our psychological states. And whether the ultimate intention was to do that in order to, again, serve us better ads, I think there's this sort of lifting of a veil into practices that people really weren't aware of. And you mentioned, you know, this wanting to sell our data, which I think, you know, if we take a step back from all of this, this specific incident raises much bigger questions about the control that we as users of the internet, of social platforms, the extent to which we know what's happening with the data that we leave online.
Reed in Brooklyn wants to follow up on this very point, I think. Hi, Reed.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So, look, as far as I can see, I can't quite see what they're doing is wrong. I'd like to distinguish between the thing they've done, the act they've performed, and the motive with which they've done it. And so if the thing is that they've done is wrong, then it's got to be by virtue of one of those two things. Now, everyone knows that Facebook uses some kind of algorithm to generate the posts that you see, because you don't see every post that every one of your friends. So the question is whether the algorithm they used produced some kind of bad consequences that another algorithm doesn't, or that the standard one doesn't. And I can't think of any particular harm that anyone has suffered as a result of them having used this algorithm. And it doesn't seem to be intrinsically wrong. I mean, of course, they've used an algorithm that causes us to feel certain things, but of course, no matter what algorithm they use, we're going to see a certain post that's going to cause us to feel certain things. So it doesn't seem to be intrinsically wrong. It doesn't seem to be wrong by virtue of its bad consequences. So the only thing that's left is that it's wrong by virtue of the motive. But the motive doesn't seem to be particularly morally pernicious. So I have a problem seeing exactly what's supposed to be the moral objection.
Adrian?
So I think some of the objections come in where, I mean, you talked about how you don't see any evidence of harm suffered. And I think it's difficult to measure because we don't actually know which users were involved in this experiment. So, for instance, one of my colleagues heard from someone yesterday who was curious if there was a way to find out, because this person at the time of the experiment, who was an active Facebook user, had really a lot of difficulty with depression and feeling suicidal. And so that person's now left wondering, you know, did Facebook do this to me? Not to oversimplify it, but, you know, the fact that people weren't given consent, and then now people are left wondering if the way that Facebook acted affected them in ways that might have hurt them, I think is a fair question.
Reed, to your point that nobody was negatively affected, what about the people who were in the group in the experiment without their knowledge that was given negative words to see if they got into a bad mood, worse mood, over the next few days? Would that be harm?
It's not obvious that it is. One, they don't know that there's a causal link between seeing negative posts and causing negativity. Schadenfreude is a positive emotion in some sense of that term. So it could just as well cause joy as it does unhappiness. Furthermore, you have to think about the baseline. The baseline is not necessarily harm versus no harm. It's harm caused by this particular algorithm as opposed to or as compared to the algorithm they would have used otherwise. Right? So if they were going to produce, you know, 3 units of harm with their original algorithm and 3 units of harm with the new algorithm, the test algorithm, then it's the same. It's a wash. It's a net effect of harm.
Maybe I'm not understanding entirely, but this assumes that they're going to use some kind of algorithm that engages in conscious mood manipulation one way or the other, right?
Well, so the term manipulation is troublesome. So, look, I mean, it's certainly going to cause you to feel certain things. But, of course, everything that everyone else does causes us to feel certain things. Any advertisement is meant to cause you to feel something. Manipulation is something different than mere causing. Manipulation requires some kind of, morally suspect motive. Otherwise, I'm just, you know, suppose I'm talking right now and I'm causing annoyance in you. I'm not manipulating you. But if I were trying to annoy you, then I might be manipulating you. And it's not clear what they were trying to do. And insofar as their motive is unclear, it's unclear whether the motive is bad. Of course, if their motive was to manipulate, that's a little bit different. Then the motive might be bad, although they might have done nothing wrong. Sometimes you can do nothing wrong, but it's still a morally suspect motive, like when you help an elderly woman across the street to get high praise.
By the way, you told my screener you're a philosophy professor, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So whether I agree with you on this point or not, I think your class would be really interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome to take it.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
So, Adrian, to his point, you wrote that you think that part of what is making people feel so betrayed is that people felt like Facebook manipulated them in a setting that's intimate. What did you mean by that?
Right. So I think, I mean, it's a question of context, I think. So while people may understand when they watch TV or encounter advertising elsewhere that an ad is designed to make them want to buy something, or even, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, well, the media all the time writes headlines that are designed to make us click. And so, yes, people see headlines and understand that the desire is to make someone read the story. But this idea that in a space where you're an algorithm may be changing your newsfeed in a way that you don't understand fully, but to find out then that algorithm is changing it specifically to alter your psychological state seems to be, I think, a betrayal for a lot of people.
Anne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you? I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is this. How exactly did the news of this experiment come to the public, to become public knowledge? Was it a whistleblower? Was it a press release? Was it something published in an educational publication? Was it a news to the shareholders? And how can we know that this that happened 2 years ago? How can we know what's happening right now?
Yeah, because this happened in 2012, but it only came out a few days ago, Adrian. How did the news come out?
Right. So, I mean, I think the question of how can we know what's happening now is a critical one, and so I hope people will keep that in their minds. The way this came out was the study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and so that's a well-respected journal. And I think that was jarring for people as well to see that not only is Facebook doing this kind of research, but they're publishing papers about it. And in some ways it's unfortunate because the backlash against this kind of research means that companies might continue to do this sort of experiment without us ever knowing and might think twice about sharing what they find. But there have been many questions raised about the ethics of how the paper got published in the first place, whether it was scrutinized to the extent that it should have been to appear in this prestigious journal, that kind of thing.
By the way, on the question, back to the philosophy professor's call of whether any harm was done to anyone, the computer scientist and author Jaron Lanier, also known as the father of virtual reality, was highly skeptical of the study in a New York Times op-ed, and he worried that the mood manipulation could have led a depressed person to do something dramatic, and that, quote, it is unimaginable that a pharmaceutical firm would be allowed to randomly, secretly sneak an experimental drug, no matter how mild, into the drinks of hundreds of thousands of people just to see what happens without ever telling those people, unquote, from Jaron Lanier. Do you think, Adrian, that Facebook might be enjoying this? The fact that Facebook is even the place where people go to complain about Facebook, because honestly, that's where we first heard about it. It was blowing up our producers' Facebook feeds because everybody was talking about it.
I mean, I don't, you know, there is the saying that no publicity is bad publicity. I don't think probably the PR people are enjoying the number of questions that I'm sending their way necessarily. And I think that the authors have seemed genuine in their, you know, responses, that they're sort of surprised by the response. One thing that stood out to me actually, though, about one of the author's postings to Facebook, of course, about this study, was that he was sorry for the anxiety it caused, but not necessarily sorry for what they did in the first place. So that was telling to me.
Another defender of Facebook, I think. Raina in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you. I want to thank you just real quick for the fracking show.
Sure.
And my point, in fact, is that's all we should be talking about 24/7. The only reason I want to defend Facebook, which, by the way, I haven't been on it in like a year, because they kept censoring me. And like if I was having some need to make a point about being wronged by someone in a humorous way, even all it would take was someone to say blah blah blah, and I was like, oh, screw this, and so I just kind of gave up because I hated them for that.
Huh.
But I just think that we are a little too precious, a little too self-important to think that, you know, I get suicidal myself sometimes, whoever, you know, the poor girl we're talking about, who none of us know, by the way, I'll remind you, it's not the same as a pharmaceutical company sneaking drugs. It's actually like writing in a diary. Why do we write in a diary? Because we need to get thoughts out, but we also secretly wish one person would get us, you know, maybe find the diary. I'm saying hypothetically, you know, like, why do we put it out there if it's such a secret, whatever. But I wanted to send Facebook in that I think it's really an amazing, you know, thing that we have available to us, a tool to fight for justice, to say things that might make people a little uncomfortable. And I was so disappointed in how quickly they run to just make it all kittens and flowers and fluffy, happy.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, so screw them, and I've kind of, like, left them for that reason. But, I mean, I still have a page and everything. But I really, what I wish we would talk about when we talk about privacy rights is what is done with the information. That's the true problem, that when, you know, people have access, you know, I'm talking about law enforcement and authorities of that nature also, because that's what they do. If, you know, if you make the mistake of opening up to some cop, you know, I smoked pot with a cop once when I was 14, ha, ha, ha. They'll somehow find a way 20 years later to use that against you.
You're making a lot of really interesting points, and I really appreciate your call. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how they censored you? I didn't quite get that. What couldn't you say on Facebook that was so horrible to them?
Well, for example, I was beaten up by an NYPD cop 20 years ago, 1993. A woman named Deborah Moore, a female black African-American cop. I grew up in Fufu, Westchester. It didn't even occur to me at the time there was anything racist going on, and of course there was.
I
realized that.
So you were getting into that history on Facebook, and they said what?
In my life, most unbelievable ways, to the point where even about a year ago, I had a local cop come take a puppy out of my arms that was being fostered.
Right. So,
and the girl who instigated that whole thing, based on some petty dumbness,
so,
just like they use this little petty stuff against you, and it really can ruin a life. And my life has, you know, I sound cheery, but my life has been pretty much destroyed by this, like, this hatefulness. And you're talking about a society as if we're a bunch of nice people. We're not a bunch of nice people. We all hate each other. Like I said, we should be talking about fracking. We should be talking about the fact that there actually is a mindset out there that's such a whore, that is so desperate, that would actually do that to our land. You know, but we don't talk about that because it sounds too violent. We start to sound like a terrorist because I care that much about the Catskills, about the river, about all of these things that I was so lucky to have grown up with. And now we've got this overpopulation problem. That's another thing we're not allowed to talk about.
And we're not going to get all the way into overpopulation, too. But, Raina, I hear you, and I hear the bottom line is about let's have some perspective on what's really important to rail against or not. And thank you very much for your call. And obviously, disclaimer, we don't know what actually happened between her and some police officer 20 years ago who she named by name. So disclaimer there. I want to get in one more call on this because I think Dan in Mattawan wants to defend the value of sad posts. Is that right, Dan?
Yeah, that's one way to put it. Thank you for having me on. Well, if you look at what people are posting when they're sad, I mean, you know, somebody creates the content. This study seems to be mostly about controlling what people experience, you know, what I read. But you have to remember that it's a social network and that every post that's being posted is posted by someone. And that could be someone who's going through any kind of personal life experience. I mean, I have friends dealing with chronic illnesses, you know, that cause them chronic pain. I have a friend who's, you know, trans, going through a painful transition. I've had friends who have died, friends who have Facebook accounts who have died, which is sort of a whole other can of worms to open up. They have a process for memorializing pages, but, you know, it's just this whole question of what is, you know, what is sad content? It's, and it doesn't stop at political content, but just it's a personal network of people, and when they're sad can even be more valuable of a time to share about it than when they're happy. Sure, I got a promotion, great, you know, I want people to hear about it, but I might really need people to hear that I'm not doing so great today.
Dan, thank you very much. And we're going to let Dan have the last word and leave it there with Adrian LaFrance, senior associate editor at The Atlantic, who's been writing about this newly revealed Facebook mood manipulation as an experiment in 2012. Adrian, thank you very much. Look what you've started with this little reporting of yours.
Thank you so much for having me.